This podcast is brought to you by the Extension and Communication for the Australian Cherry Industry Project, funded by Hort Innovation using the Cherry Research and Development Levy and funds from the Australian Government. For more information, please visit horticulture.com.au. Welcome to the Cherry Picked podcast, the podcast that brings you the sweetest insights, tips and stories from the world of cherry growing, packing and consuming. I'm your host, Jess, and I'm here to connect with growers, researchers and enthusiasts to share the wisdom, experience and innovations that make cherry growing a rewarding experience. Whether you're tending to a backyard tree or managing hectares of orchard, this podcast is your go-to resource for everything cherry related. So let's get into it. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of the Cherry Picked podcast. And today I'm very grateful to have Mr. Mike Omeg all the way from the States to have a bit of a chat to us today about his cherry orchard, his experiences growing cherries in Oregon, and also a little bit about his background, his family, and why he enjoys being in the cherry industry. G'day, Mike. How are you going today?
I'm doing great, Jessica. I hope you are too.
Yes, I'm doing very well. And I'm so glad to have you online this morning, or your afternoon. But I'd love to start this podcast a little bit around your cherry orchard and about yourself, how you got into the cherry industry.
Well, my family has been farming here in the Dalles for a long time, over 100 years. I'm the fifth generation to farm our home place, our lands. My great-great-grandparents gave my great-grandparents the piece of land where I live with my wife and kids. And so my children would be the sixth generation. Our house was, you know, built in 1908, over 100 years ago. And so farming is in our blood. When I was young, cherries were just one part of our farm. When I was young, we raised cattle and we cut wheat. We had a few hundred acres of dry land wheat and about 45 cow-calf pairs. And then we raised cherries, of course, and cut hay, and we had apples and apricots as well. But times change, and we've changed with them, which is always something that's a lot of fun and brings its own challenges. And basically, all of our ground now is cherries. And then in 2018, my family joined up with our longtime family friends and neighbors, the Baileys, that had Orchard View. And my family lands, all of our orchards are managed as a part of Orchard View. I also work at Orchard View, where I'm director of operations, and I'm in charge of all of the fruit growing. We're an integrated company. We grow, pick, and pack and sell cherries. And so my job is to get them grown and delivered here to the packing house. And then my colleagues here get them packed and sold. And now we're a vertically integrated company. We went from 300 acres of my family farm. Now we're a company that is almost 3,600 acres of all cherries.
Wow. So you've probably got the hardest job of getting the fruit grown and then getting it into the pack house. It's really
well. I tell everyone here I have the hardest job, and but you know we all work together. We all collaborate and work together. You know, our business used to be all just family members working here, but we're a much larger company now, and everybody's role is equally important in ever more challenging times.
Yeah,
and it's probably the hardest work I do, done professionally in my entire life, of course, now, but it's, I would say, the most rewarding as well, professionally.
Oh, I think there would be many listeners that agree that cherry growing is very rewarding. So what inspired you to be a cherry grower? I know, obviously, you've got your fifth generation, so there's something keeping you coming back. Is there a reason why you've continued to grow and expand your business in the cherry sector?
Well, like many young people, I was going to go do my own thing, and I did for quite some time. After graduate school, I worked with the Oregon State University, and then I worked with the Natural Resource Conservation Service on pesticide and pest management related issues. I've always had a passion for the pest and disease management side of the cherry business. That's where I found my niche and my most interest. And so I did that. But then in 2005, my dad had a heart attack, and he's fine. He's still around. Oh, he still eats like the doctor says he shouldn't, of course. But my dad had a heart attack, and that was an event that prompted me to look at what I was doing professionally, what I wanted to do. And, what I saw was I was doing more and more bureaucratic work, more in the office and not in the field. And I was hiring staff to work for me that did the fun stuff that I really enjoyed, the boots on the ground sort of thing. And so I decided that I wanted to join the family farm. And we went through a process for a few years of succession planning. Mm-hmm. That's a critical, critical importance for my parents and myself to define our roles, to define ownership with I have a sibling, my sister, and work out how all that was going to be. Because I think that's one of the biggest challenges that families face is how to transition from one generation to the next. And I'd seen some great failures in, with friends and neighbors and how they did that. And I didn't want that to happen to me as an individual or to my family. And so we worked hard to give it a go. Mm. And it's been a success. In 2009, I took over the financial risk with our business, started being the person that either makes it or breaks it. That's how I got into cherries. Where we live is a beautiful, beautiful part of the country. The cherry business is a great business. I think all the listeners that are cherry growers know you have to be about half crazy to enjoy the chaos of cherry business, growing cherries. There's a lot that has a big impact on the outcome of a season that we don't control. But I think that the challenge of the unknown, the challenge of being able to get crops harvested with over 1,000 people in the field during harvest. Mm. I just really enjoy fast and furious figuring things out minute by minute and coming up with a plan and seeing the success. And there's a lot of pleasure in growing food. I think it's amazing to see a cherry come from a dormant bud in the wintertime to a beautiful piece of fruit that you give it to anybody, even a little kid that can't even talk yet. They eat that cherry and they light up. Yeah. And that's something I find really fulfilling, and I'm able to make a good living at it. And that's important too. So here I am. And I was lucky enough to find somebody who loved me and was willing to marry me and kids, be a part of this business. She's from the city. To get her to come out here to rural Oregon and be a part of a cherry family was a monumental feat. And I thank every day that my wife, Lindsay, joined me in it. So here we are.
And that's a beautiful story. And it warms my heart to think that it's still a family business and you've got five children and your wife, Lindsay, all happy to support you. And that's something really special. I wanted to touch on as well, when you were talking about beautiful Oregon and growing cherries in Oregon and you're in a really nice part of America there, a lot of our growing regions are quite diverse and we have lots of different challenges that might be localized to different growing regions. Is there particular challenges in Oregon that you face when growing cherries, as adverse weather conditions or extreme heat?
Yeah, weather is probably one of the top three factors that we can't control as growers. It just takes one night of rain to take away everything that you've done for the whole season from you. But you know, we face challenges here. Every place that grows cherries is going to face a challenge. It can be very cold. It could be summer rains, you know, wind. Cherries are susceptible to many different weather events, hot, cold, and wet, being probably the top, the most important. Here in our region, we've noticed a change over time to where previous decades, we were able to be very predictable as to we would come out of dormancy in the spring. We would have fairly predictable time between our bloom and our harvest, and we could plan around there not being rain in the summer. We're in an area that doesn't have rain, and we're very fortunate because of that. But that's become a real unpredictable thing. And so within the past 3 or 4 seasons, we've had historically unprecedented events due to weather. For example, 2 years ago, we had snow during bloom, during April here. We had 6 inches of snow on top of cherries in full bloom. Unprecedented. Nobody had ever seen that. That was followed by temperatures that were the hottest it had ever been during harvest. We had 118 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know if you can put up on the screen or someone will have to translate that into Celsius. But that's blazing hot, 118 degrees Fahrenheit. That, you know, that just destroyed susceptible varieties. It was hard on all fruit, but some varieties such as Skeena just melted on the tree. And then, you know, this past season, this season, 2023, we had a very, very cool spring, unprecedented low temperatures, just cool. And we had the latest bloom on record. And then we got hot right after bloom. And we had the shortest time period that we're aware of between bloom and when we started harvesting. And so that led to all kinds of challenges. And we don't live in a a vacuum. What happens for us here in Oregon, our success is tied to Californian cherries, tied to cherries grown in Washington, and then our friends up north of the Canadian border up in BC, you know, we're all related, and we all had weather events that made our cherries be ready right on top of each other, which made a marketing disaster here for us. So, you know, the weather is what the weather is. We can't control it. We have to roll with it. And there's opportunity in these challenges for those of us who can make a plan that's solid enough to survive. There's opportunities after the storm calms, so to speak, and we're counting on that here at Orchard View.
It echoes a lot of what we see here in Australia, particularly around timing and how one region sort of flows on to the next. That's a lot we see in Australia, starting up, you know, in northern New South Wales, Queensland, and WA on the other side of Australia, and we kind of move down as the growing season continues. But when you have these weather challenges, it really whacks them all on top, and then we're all hitting the market at the same time. So I hear that, but I wanted to ask, is there anything that you implement on your orchard to kind of mitigate some of these challenges? I mean, here in Australia, there are some growing regions that are picking up the protected covers to mitigate rain. Some people are using overhead sprinklers for heat reduction. Is there anything that you're implementing on your orchard to kind of have a little bit more control over the uncontrollables?
I think the biggest thing that we as growers can do for managing weather events is to ensure that our trees are have the resources they need to be at their optimal condition, the best health, tree health, if you will. Because a tree that is really solid and healthy, it's been provided with, in our case, irrigation management that it needs, properly managed in other areas, especially nutrition-wise. Those trees are much more resilient to extremes and weather, whether that be cold or heat. And the fruit that's grown on those trees is going to have the wherewithal to endure a weather event and then still be a piece of fruit that the customer wants to buy And let's face it, that's really the challenge that what's going to keep those of us in business that want to be in business. We have to have people want to continue to buy cherries, and our cherries have to be more desirable in the marketplace than, say, cherries from others. They have to make it and be sellable. And that oftentimes is a challenge in these weather events. Huge crops, you know, with small cherries that are of inferior quality are bad for everybody. Everyone having fruit on the market at the same time is bad for everybody. But we as growers can make sure that our orchards are in the top condition, that are producing top quality cherries that have a good consumer experience. Those are going to be the most important thing I think that we can do is take good care of our fruit, especially nutritionally.
You've got different practices around improving conservation. And we were talking just before we started recording about regenerative agriculture. Can you tell us a little bit more about why that's important to you and how you think that contributes to good nutrition or good orchard management and healthy trees?
Well, I think that, my interest in I have a passion for just growing crops, growing cherries in particular. I just love to know always be looking at finding a better way to do something that's been done for generations. Cherries are nothing new. The Romans picked cherries. I want to focus on always doing better. Mm-hmm. I want to have a constant improvement in how I go about things, which means I constantly have to be learning, exploring, and planning, managing. And so my interest in regenerative agriculture was not because I felt that what I was doing was wrong and I needed to reinvent myself, so to speak. That wasn't what it was. I was simply seeing that it was becoming more and more difficult to have novel and effective ways to farm under purely conventional methods. I thought that the untapped area of most opportunity for improvement was in looking at the soils. You know, we were farming the tree from the soil up, right in that tree is to the maximum, but we weren't doing a lot from the soil down. And in my opinion, the best information that was available out there was in the more regenerative agriculture area for soil management, soil improvement, and how we go about farming our soils. I think it's fairly widely accepted that there are things that you can do to harm your soil, and that's a negative for you as a farmer in the short term and especially in the long term. You know, if we're just out there sort of strip mining, so to speak, our soils, that's not a multi-generation business future. And I want to have the farm be in business and producing crops for the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. So I got, I found that the regenerative community of farming had more information that I felt was more applicable and could be implemented on our farm. I think that the challenge with that is in how to adapt those techniques on scale to make things practical, scalable, and economical. Because in the end, my fruit has to compete in a wholesale market where the person doesn't care how it's grown that's buying our cherries.
Yeah.
So I have to have a cherry that can be competitive anonymously. And so whatever I do on the regenerative front has to pencil in a conventional marketplace. And I found it to be quite challenging and rewarding as to how to pick and choose what regenerative practices we utilize, how to adapt those to our economic and management constraints and figure it out. And that's been a lot of fun. But I think that it is I think it's a missed opportunity for folks to dismiss a technique because it's associated with organic production, to dismiss a technique because it's associated with small scale agricultural production, you know, say farmers market type stuff. You know, I've listened to many a talk that included putting manure in cow horns and orienting it towards the full moon and, you know, things like that. You know, I think if that works for folks, that's great. But there's also a lot of good information in that very same community that you can pick and choose from. And so we need to be open to new ideas. And I just happened to found that to be an area that was rife with opportunity, in my opinion, to apply here on my own farm.
Yeah, and I think that's when you touched upon the making sure the cost benefit was still there because you are competing in that wholesale market. That's something that Australia, we're picking up now, particularly in our research projects around what actually is the cost to the grower and then what's the benefit and how do we quantify that. So unfortunately, we're in an age where the cost of inputs are forever rising. So it's becoming harder and harder for our cherry growers to, you know, make a profit, similar, I would assume, with the American growers as well. But I think, like what you said, trying and seeing what works for your farm, because every farm is different, but improving reducing the reliance really on fertilizers and synthetic chemicals, if we can use practices, will be better in the long run. So I'm sure we could talk for hours upon your different practices, but I wanted to just hone in on that having a go and trying maybe something from that you've seen on a smaller scale farm or a home orchard might be worth having a crack at.
Or just another crop. You know, there's a lot of work that's done in vineyards that's really applicable. And I think that not limiting yourself to just, we need to look at orchards other places, but other cropping systems, you know, especially perennial cropping systems, blueberries, caneberries, orchards, nut orchards, vineyard and that sort of thing there's a lot that's in common there. And also the constraints are also much in common. You know, I'll just give an example. It was always easy for me if I wanted more nitrogen to just buy it and put it in the tank and get it put on. But boy, starting what, 3 or 4 years ago now, it might be 4 years ago now, at least our pricing for nitrogen, if we just used urea as the base price, you know, I think we went from about $200 a ton for urea, you know, up to like $1,700 a ton in 2 years. And boy, I will tell you that the arithmetic on a napkin becomes pretty easy when you say, hey, we should be thinking about some ways that we can reduce reliance on nitrogen to grow our crops. And many of the things that efforts I've made and many, you know, other folks that have grown, say, organic crops or regenerative crops where that was not an option for them, they've paid all the school of hard knocks to figure out techniques that can grow their crops without the use of cheap nitrogen. So don't try to reinvent the wheel yourself. See what they're doing and adapt it to your own production system, because boy, now nitrogen's become a real detriment if you just have to go out and buy it at the whims of the market. And geopolitical factors now with challenges with energy costs that, you know, I'm going to venture to say it's going to skyrocket here soon, just by the geopolitical nature and global marketplace for energy. We need to be looking at better ways for us to reduce inputs on that are energy intensive, with nitrogen being the most, I think, blaring example of that. That's my own thoughts. Everybody needs to do what they think's right for them. But I think it behooves us, if we want to be in business, to learn that. And if that means you're doing regenerative things, that's great. That could be a benefit.
Yeah. I really like that point around having a look outside to the cherry industry and grabbing from other industries. People have done the work, and how do we implement that on our orchard? That's a really good point there, Mike.
And just to follow up on that, if I may, you know, the organic cherry industry is very small. Yeah. In the United States, at least, it is just so rare and so uncommon to have a grower of scale that grows organically. Mm. However, the organic wine grape industry is much more mature, mm-hmm. and has been around for a much longer time. And those growers are, in some cases, multi-generation now. There's a lot to be learned there. And in my opinion, they're just a sister industry.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, offered in Australia as well. They're right next door to our cherry orchards. So it's
I raise a few wine grapes here on the farm. They're the, you know, we do it for, sometimes I wonder why we do it, but you know, we have got 14 acres of wine grapes ourselves. Yeah. I don't drink, so it's totally lost on me. It's just pure headache. And it's headache before the wine, not after the
not
wine.
Not after you've had a couple there. Well, I really appreciate your time today, Mike. I've got one last question for you before I let you get back out in the orchard, but I wanted to know what you see the future for the cherry industry, and that can be globally or for America, and what you're most excited for the next few years as a cherry grower.
So I'm most excited about the opportunity that we still have in cherries, and that is people want to buy cherries. They're excited by cherries. Mm-hmm. I think it provides us with an opportunity that many crops don't have. You know, in our case in the U.S., cherries are a seasonal thing where people are excited by them being in the store and then they're going to be gone. And that's an opportunity that we as an industry can capitalize on and kind of keep us from becoming a truly commodity, global commodity crop. Mm-hmm. You know, all the challenges that you can't grow cherries everywhere and they don't store and you have to do everything right to harvest them, say in Australia, and ship them to Asia. Mm-hmm. You know, all those things actually provide us as cherry growers with opportunity. And for me, I think the most exciting thing for me is to figure out the way that we can grow cherries that do well in the orchard, survive all the different challenges and, you know, weather-wise and harvest-wise, irrigation-wise that we have, that make it through the packing process and through transport to the retail shelf, and they still look great in the packaging, so good that somebody buys them at a price that still makes us as growers money. Mm. And then they take them home, they can sit in their refrigerator, then that person eats that cherry and they want to go back and buy some more, you know, and just keep on doing that through the whole season. I'm most excited about that because folks genuinely get excited about cherries.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, potato growers, but I don't see little kids in the store getting excited when there's a bag of potatoes in their cart. But I've seen many times just observing, and I'm totally biased, when those cherries go in, those little kids are already eating them.
Yeah.
So I think that that's what gets me excited every day, and figuring out a way to do that better and stay in business all the while is just a lot of fun.
And I think as well, in Australia, we're very lucky in the fact that cherries are associated with Christmas. And so we have that extra excitement. And I agree. Who doesn't even like looking at a photo of a cherry? I mean, it's beautiful. And we see the same in Australia. Everyone's excited now to get those first season cherries. And that's the best opportunity, I think. So thank you so much, Mike, for taking your time today. I know you're probably very busy finishing up from your season and getting organized for the next season coming. Is there anywhere that growers could find you or get in touch with you if they had any other questions?
Sure. Orchardview.com is our company website. You can email through there on our webpage. I have a YouTube channel that I've been neglecting for quite a while, but there's a lot of good oldies but goldies on there. If you just search Mike Omeg on YouTube, there's all kinds of videos on there. I think I swear in a lot of them, but I am a farmer. But considering most of the Australians I know, I think they'll be fine. So that's another place to look up the cherry work I do. And I, you know, you can learn a little bit about poultry if you're interested in really high quality poultry and that sort of thing too. And so that's how you can look me up. You know, unfortunately, I don't have time to answer everybody's question and to help everybody out. But sometimes if it's a question I think's real interesting, out of the blue, I'll call you on your phone. That's how I prefer, is people leave their phone number. I don't email long emails, but I'll just give you a call. And I've done that to a few folks from Australia, actually. So,
oh, we'll really appreciate that, Mike. And what I'll do is I'll link the YouTube channel in the show notes. But thank you so much, Mike, for coming on. I know the listeners are going to love this episode, and I wish you all the best for you and your family.
Thank you. Enjoy your day. Thank you. Enjoy your day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cherry Picked podcast. If you like what you heard, please subscribe so you don't miss any episodes and refer us to a friend. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, please get in touch via the contact information in the show notes. Happy growing, and we will catch up in the next episode.